Now, the introduction which I give at the beginning of a talk is mostly to get me back into speaking again. When you're really quiet, you know, you don't want to speak. I did try that once when I was a young monk in Thailand. They asked me to go up and give a talk for an hour. You know, and that's what some monk would always have to give a talk. So I sat down and said, here's my talk today. And I was silent for an hour. I got into trouble for that. I just, you know, that was being like personal. I felt like the quietness was the most important. But for this week, someone actually emailed a request for a talk. And it was a young person. And one of the reasons they asked for this request, they said, well, look, you know, sometimes you talk all about meditation or some of these other Buddhist principles, you know, the heart of Buddhism. But, you know, how are those principles actually applied in some of the most difficult parts of life? He said her and many of her friends were talking about the problems in places like Palestine. As a Buddhist, how can you deal with that? What does it do to you? And what's a wise, compassionate, kind way to deal with some of those incredible problems in our world? First of all, as a Buddhist monk, you know, I don't know too much about that. You've got to be honest. You know, I don't go looking at the news all the time. But just so my talk about this or advice about that, it's going to be very general, just about violence and the damage it can be done, but also just out of the lack of hope or meaning which people take away from those newscasts or articles. One of the things which I've known in my life, I'm 72 years of age now, so I've got some experience, but not in wars. Some of the things which I've learned, you know, from some of the most difficult times of life, it's just these things happen. But why can't we find much better ways of dealing with it? You know, one of those ways of dealing with it, and it's a basic Buddhist idea, is please don't just look at the newscasts. Because the newscasts often are there to actually to basically excite you or offend you or sort of depress you, to get a strong emotional response from you. Somehow or other that makes us feel alive. As a monk, obviously, I prefer the more silence, staying in my cave, meditating. You don't know too much about what happens in the world, but you have to deal with it sooner or later. So the first thing I would say is, you know, one of the teachings which I took on board as a young Buddhist, and I'll even say it in the Pali, Asewa Naccha Balanang, association with the wise, you know, is a great blessing. Association with fools, it makes you a bit foolish. It's who you actually live with, associate with. What the Buddha said is Kalyana Mitta, it's good friends. If your good friend is like violence on TV or internet, if that's in the, or the articles of violence, you know, in game shows or whatever, then that gives you a different perspective on life. So one of the things I would encourage is always to see if at all possible you can stay with good people, kind people. Not just bad news, which is on places like, in my day anyway, it was a TV sets, but the good news which is around. There is lots of good news, but for some reason people ignore that. They saw it as rotten news, and they become perpetrators of rotten news as well. They're kind of supporting it. They give violence oxygen so it can keep going on. To say this, it is just the old saying, it's one of those stories. I've got to tell stories every now and again, you know, because if I don't tell stories, people get bored. philosophy just doesn't work for people. You're told what to believe all the time. Philosophy makes your brain work. Imagine trying to be logical on a Friday evening after you spent all week at work. Your brain wants a break. So that particular story is about the elephant. They said a king's elephant in the time of the Buddha. A really well-behaved king's elephant. In those days, having a good elephant, if you are a ruler, was like having a Rolls-Royce car, you know, or a Mercedes with so much protection there for you. You can get anywhere you want, you can go fast, and because the elephant was really high, then you could be actually safe from any animals who prowled on the floor of the jungle. So anyway, the king had one of these really good elephants, and one day when he went to see his elephant, the elephant squirted water on him for no reason. What do you do that for? Maybe you know, known someone in your family, they're usually really good, but every now and again they do something stupid, and it's not April Fool's Day. So what do you do that for? And sometimes the trainer of the elephant. The elephant would wait until the elephant trainer was right behind him before pooing. You know, as a monk in Sri Lanka, there's plenty of Sri Lankans here. You know, sometimes you have ceremonies in Sri Lanka. And they're called Parihara. I pronounced it wrong, but you know what I'm talking about. The elephant goes in front, the monk goes right behind, and a lot of other people behind them. I've done that once or twice when I was in Sri Lanka. That is very, very scary. You know why? Because there's a big elephant in front of you, and you have to walk behind them. I wasn't so scared about if the elephant poos. I mean, it's a big amount of poo an elephant has. Imagine they passed wind. Oh. So that's what this naughty elephant would do when the king or some other important person was walking right behind him. So why are you doing this for? He thought he must be sick, some sort of disease, that his character had suddenly become bad. If you've had like a son or a daughter in your house, and you know, they're usually really good and respectful, and then they suddenly change and think, what's going on? Why have they changed their character and become naughty and hard to deal with? So anyway, the king tried to get all these elephant experts to try and solve the problem. No one could find out what was wrong with the elephant until this wise person in the king's retinue. They always have these stories about these really smart people in the king's retinue. And I like those stories. I don't know if I told you this 2 weeks ago about one of these ministers in this. This was actually in the court of the King of Thailand many years ago, so I was told. And he was so smart. You know, one of these people we call like a know-it-all. He was arrogant, but he always actually did know much more than anybody else. So that made everybody else really jealous. So jealous, they all met together and say, how can we get rid of this know-it-all? You know, he was so sort of angry at him for knowing more than we do. So they came up with this strategy. I don't know if you have a know-it-all in your family or in your office or in your BSWA committee. But anyway, they made this plan. We know he's very proud. We'll try and bring up his confidence and his pride until he goes one step too far. But praising him in front of the king. You're such a wise minister. You're so smart. He said, yeah, that's me. He's really so arrogant. You probably know more than any of us do. Yeah, I do. And then they were catching him. You probably even know what we're thinking. Oh yes, I know what you're all thinking. And that was the trap. How can you prove that you know what someone else is thinking? If I say, you know, I know what you're thinking, and then you don't have to admit it. Even if I get it right, you say, no, I'm thinking of something else. You can't prove it. But this was such a smart minister. He said, yes, I know what each one of you are thinking. Okay, you tell us, what are we thinking? And they were going to say, that's wrong anyway, no matter what he said. Tell us what we're all thinking. And this wise minister said, replied, you are all thinking patriotic, kind thoughts to His Majesty the King. Of course, they'd say, yeah, actually, that's true. If he denied that, you know, he'd have his head chopped off. That's kind of wisdom. But anyway, so this particular wise minister, not the minister who just could read people's minds or put them in a position where they have to admit yes, he went in there one evening next to the elephant, trying to find out why was this elephant sick. Whenever you want to find reasons for things, number one, you've got to know it first of all. Get close enough to get, and don't think you know, to suspend all of your knowledge, and then you can actually see things. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Because sometimes you think this can't be true. It's not what it says in the books. Clear your mind and then you may be able to see truth or hear truth. That's what happened to the minister. Because after a while, he started hearing all these strange sounds behind the elephant stall. He crept through the jungle and he could see there was people there meeting behind the elephant stall. And he could listen to them, what they were talking about. They were talking about drugs and alcohol and getting money from people. It was a band of thieves. They were meeting there every evening because it was secluded. They thought it was safe. And as they were meeting there, talking about their business and all the bad things they were going to do and drinking alcohol at the same time, they were actually influencing the elephant. Even though the elephant could not understand human language, nevertheless was actually influenced by what we call these days the vibes. There's really bad vibes behind the elephant stall. And the elephant just picked up on that. And that's why it became a bad elephant. Even each one of you may have a good kid. You know, you meet with some bad people, and your kid starts to pick up some of those bad habits. And because of that, they become bad people. At least that's how they behave. So the minister knew exactly what to do. He went back without the thieves and bandits knowing, told the king, had them all arrested the next day, and invited the monks and the nuns to go there to chant and talk about Dhamma, just like I'm talking here to you tonight. Just nice conversations about kindness and peace and meditation and forgiving and letting go and making good karma and joining our Buddhist Society West Australia Committee. All those wonderful good thoughts and ideas. And it worked. That elephant soon became a really, not even better than before, a really kind, gentle, caring elephant because of association with wise people. With wise ideas, with wise thoughts. And that is one of the reasons why many of you come and spend time at Bodhinyana Monastery or Dhammasara Nansa Monastery. Why do you actually come there to stay for a few days? It's because you get influenced by all those beautiful nuns at Dhammasara, all those kind monks at Bodhinyana, you get what we call brainwashed. And you become much better human beings. That's why it almost comes with a guarantee. You send your kids to Dhammasara for a few days and they come back improved children. You send your husband there, it's like an old car which is clanking up and down, making lots of noise, and he comes like tuned up. It's a wonderful place. But the problem is, you get sort of conditioned and improved by the presence of the monks and the nuns. But the monks and the nuns, you've got it. We get influenced by some of the stuff you do. But we're strong enough for that. But there's a lot of truth behind that. Who do you associate with? Who do you hang out with? Now, what do you look at? What do you read? What do you listen to? And that has an influence on you, much more than you'd imagine. That's one of the reasons why people do get depressed even by watching, you know, all of the violence or all the tragedies, the sadness, the hurt which happens. It'd be great to be able to balance that at least by coming to places like monasteries, places like retreats, places like this place over here. When was the last time anyone got hit here? How many of you deserve to be hit? None of you. That was one of the beautiful lessons which I learned straight away from Buddhism. There was no punishment in Buddhism. And that was really weird for me. How can you create discipline, especially in a monastery, without punishment? We do it through trust and kindness, inspiring people, not sort of killing them or flogging them or putting them in, asking them to stop eating. That's actually against our rules to do any of that. And if you don't know this story, again, this is not a joke, but a true story. When I first took over Bodhinyana Monastery as a head honcho, you know what head honcho means? Abbot, boss, spiritual dictator. Okay, you know that one. Very good. So that means when there was any problem or difficulty, they'd come to me to try and solve it. And so I always remember this guy, just come, I think from overseas. He was kind of a Buddhist, but he didn't know too much about Buddhism. He trying to be an anagarika. You know, we have all these rules in a monastery. You know, one of those rules is you're not allowed to eat in the afternoon, evening, night time, not until the dawn of the following day. So this guy, he was waiting to see me early one morning. He said, Ajahn Brahm, I'm terribly sorry. I broke my precepts. Sometimes it's really weird that, you know, when people want to admit something, they start almost like crying. You broke a precept. What did you do? Who did you kill? That's one of the precepts. You're not supposed to kill anybody. I didn't kill anybody. No, I was hungry in the evening. I was so hungry, I snuck into the kitchen and I made myself a sandwich. You know what I did with that sandwich? I ate it. Oh, I feel terrible. Now sometimes, that is against our rules, but my goodness, it's not a capital offence, making a sandwich for yourself. How do you get angry at somebody doing that? So instead, you know, what I was taught what to do is admit it, good. The next thing is try and help the poor fellow. So look, eat more at lunch. I've been eating one meal a day for almost 50 years now. Look what's happened to me. I get enough one meal. Actually, two meals for breakfast sometimes. But eat more at lunchtime. Number two, you've seen all these extras we could eat in the evening. Those of you who've been on retreat, stayed at monastery, what is allowable in the evening? Cheese, chocolate. Okay, I must confess, this evening when I got to my room coming from Bodhinyana Monastery this afternoon, I saw that someone had offered me a, I confess, it's not breaking any precept, it's a dark chocolate Easter bunny. I've always already consumed the ears. Please don't offer me any more, okay? I'll give him a fatter. But anyway, I don't feel guilty about that. I do work hard. So anyway, this guy said, I said, these are things you can eat. It's not breaking the rules. They're there for you. If you feel hungry, you need extra energy, please take some. I gave him all this advice on what he could eat. And then afterwards, that's when he said to me, that's not good enough, Ajahn Brahm. I need to be punished. He said that. He said, look, if you don't punish me or give me some penance, I will do it again. That's my character, he said. So he put me on the spot. As a kind Buddhist monk, what kind of punishment can I get for him? And I figured out this beautiful punishment. If any of you think you deserve a punishment because you did something wrong today or this week, later on, if you, I saw it this afternoon, this evening, you go into the reception area, there's this beautiful cat. You seen it? Over there? That's right. You're sentenced to 50 strokes of the cat. One, two. Learn some compassion and kindness. You don't need punishment, more pain in your life. You need more kindness to yourself. And that's more powerful than any pain or punishment or imprisonment or something. Be kind. You don't realize how incredibly powerful that is, especially when you don't expect it. So that was his punishment, 50 strokes of the cat. Looking. Now that is a different way of healing and curing. Even if you've got any sicknesses in your gut or cancers, kindly be kind to those, what was it, bacteria or viruses in your body. Personally, I've done that so many times. In 50 years as a monk, you do have some injuries or sicknesses or something. It always works. I'm not dead yet. You're just kind to that part of your body, our poor body. Sorry that, you know, I hit you, had a bruise. You're so kind to it. Everything kind of relaxes. And certainly you never think you don't deserve happiness or peace or good health. That's something which really does cause lots of illnesses. The idea is psychological self-harm. You can't forgive yourself. But anyway, back to that little elephant. When so many people are talking to that elephant like that, of course the elephant improves. Of course the people who read all those news stories, all the negative parts and images of people who've been injured, who have been hurt, who have been limbs taken off by bombs or something, whose family have been blown to smithereens, whose homes have been destroyed. I've never had a home destroyed, but I do remember when we had a huge bushfire many years ago, a Crown fire. And I remember just Ajahn Jagro was the abbot, but he was off down south somewhere. So as I was in charge, we tried everything we could, you know, to try and protect this monastery. Well, I was the main builder, many of you know that. I put so much energy and effort into building that place. And when you saw the fire, it was a Crown fire. What year was that? 1991. Big Crown fire, over 46 degrees before the fire came. One of the hottest days in Western Australia, and certainly in Serpentine. When I saw that, things don't burn, they actually explode. You know, because it's so hot, all the eucalypt trees, all the eucalyptus oil vaporizes, and it becomes this blue sheath around the trees. And there's a spark, you know, usually from the other tree down, downwind, or just down the hill from that. One spark, bang! It was like explosions going up. And I remember, you know, being evacuated by one of the bushfire people, the head of the bushfire brigade. He became a really good friend, Dave Gossage, his name was. He was actually head of the bushfire brigade in Perth for a while. But I remember him sort of looking at these exploding trees. Do you think anything can survive? I think, no, no way. This was really violent. It's like bombs going off. So I remember just evacuating and thinking, there's going to be no monastery left. Honestly, I'm not exaggerating on that. I think all that hard work for so many years was for nothing. But you know, I never thought like that. How can you say it was for nothing? It was all destroyed. We can always build it up again. I had this great positive idea that what was built can be destroyed, but it would be built up again. It's almost maybe because of my underlying understanding of rebirth. Human beings, each one of you, you know, you've done so much good work, so much learning, so much kindness. You've learned so much in this life. You can't just say you're going to die and it's all going to be disappeared. Things do get reborn, regenerated. We're all phoenixes. Where's Phoenix gone? One of our committee members. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there she is. That's her name, Phoenix. Sometimes she disappears, but she comes back next week. It's a nice name. The whole idea that you can't really destroy things, they just get transformed. It's like your life, your kindness, your energy. And of course, I can, even though it was so many years ago, I do remember just being taken up to that monastery after being evacuated overnight and then going there early in the morning and seeing that forest. Those of you who've been here will understand what I'm talking about. Seeing there was no greenery there at all. Every leaf had been burnt. So you could actually look right into the monastery, see all of those huts. There was no damage. It was kind of incredible. But you had this big view for so many meters. You can't see that these days, because there was nothing which was hiding or secluding anything. And it all came back again. So that's one of the reasons why nothing gets lost. Sometimes that's a problem with people who've only got a small view of like wars and destructions. We think that everything is lost. It's not. You know, out of those wars, we learn, we grow. I know that because when I was born, it was after the Second World War. I was not there when that war happened, just born a couple of years afterwards. And I still remember the bomb sites in London. Still remember my grandmother, every time there was a thunderstorm, she would stop whatever she was doing and go to the stairs, which was supposed to be the safest place. That was how she dealt with the trauma. I remember asking, did you have any experiences to my mother during those bombings? And she said she didn't remember, but apparently she was in the house when the terrace house next door took a direct hit. Everyone, the neighbors next door, in a terrace house, only a few meters to that house and the house where my mum was staying in, as an 11-year-old girl or something, took a direct hit, and her house was also destroyed. And her arm was lacerated with the flying glass. Everybody had their stories at that time. But they also tell the story that somehow those experiences kind of changed a lot of their lives. One of the things which changed is a huge amount of harmony there and helping one another. They had to. Any type of racism kind of disappeared. Any type of discrimination kind of disappeared. You couldn't have that. Everyone was looking after one another. And even like ownership, people would care about one another so well. I know many people at that time, like my grandparents and other sort of parents and uncles, they would always say that was an amazing time. So much pain and destruction. So many buildings and houses lost. So much incredible. That was actually my own father, you know, when he told me, I asked him quite a few times about his religion, and he said he was an atheist. He said the reason he was an atheist, because he'd seen so much destruction during that Second World War. He said, I couldn't believe in a kind God. I mentioned that to someone today even, that it was, I do my research, Saint Augustine. He said, and he was actually a top theologian in the Christian church. This was before Catholicism and Anglican split. And he was saying, you can't imagine a supreme God being who is both all-powerful and all-kind. If it was all-powerful, then why does it let these tragedies of wars in places like Palestine happen? If it was all-kind, he's not all-powerful. Again, he wouldn't allow this to happen, it's just too much. But anyway, that's my father. But nevertheless, it happens. What is its meaning? The question, why? Why all these wars over religion, who's right and who's wrong? That's the other thing, a Buddhist solution to such arguments. When I ever get too serious giving talks, I just can't even stand it for myself. People actually turn off. So this is one of the reasons why I'm now going to give the Buddhist solution to arguments. Many of you heard this before, but here it comes. There were two people having an argument. They were just being married. Now you know the story, don't you? You already run ahead to it. They'd just been married, and they were walking through the forest, a nice afternoon stroll. And as they were walking through the forest, they heard this sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And straight away she said, oh darling, can you hear that? That's a chicken. Let's change it a bit, shall we? Because I keep telling it's a chicken all the time. Darling, can you hear that? That's a cow. And he said, a cow flying through the air going quack, quack. It can't be a cow. That is a duck. No, I'm sure that is a cow. It can't be. It's a cow. It's a duck. And then finally he looked at her and decided it's not worth getting angry with a woman he loved. So he squeezed her hand gently and said, darling, I think you may be right. There is a cow. And it went quack, quack again. Thank you. And they had this wonderful, had this wonderful walk together in peace and harmony. And in that version of the story, the guy was smart. Who cares whether it's a cow or a duck? Is that really important in life? Honestly, being right? Or is it more important being in harmony? Especially if it's your partner being in love. What's more important? Which is the right religion? Or living in peace together? Any of you have ever had an argument with people you like and love and care for? That's where wars come from. They're just exaggerations of that, amplifications of people that I'm right, you're wrong. So, that's the meaning of wars, teaching us to be much more, I suppose, open, at peace. Not so much thinking we're right and everybody else is wrong. and sometimes even stretching the truth a little bit, you know, for the sake of harmony rather than being right. That's one of the reasons why any philosophies, you're right, you may be right, but that's not the point. Physically or intellectually right, but emotionally wrong. You don't know how to live and be kind with one another. That's one of the reasons, you know, even with things like Buddhism, with the Dhamma. Now you try and express, you know, the teachings of the Buddha in the way which I think the teachers have wanted more than anything else, to lead to peace inside but also harmony in our world. How do we lead to harmony in our world? I think it was always, okay, what, I think the whole story, I should tell you the whole story. This was when I was, I like doing some weird stuff sometimes. This was at a, not that weird, it was an interfaith chaplaincy conference at UWA many years ago. And after they given my presentation, this guy, you know, put his hand up and asked this question. And what really sort of kind of worried me, the guy who asked the question was this, you know, Australian scholar, intellectual, called Frank Brennan. You know, he was a Jesuit, but he was so highly respected that I think the government at that time, I forget who it was, they asked him to start a committee to add a human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. And so, you know, it's one of the first time you saw it, like a Buddhist, and he asked the question, Ajahn Brahm, no, seriously, what's the Buddhist concept of God? Your friends might ask you that question. You come to the temple here, God, how do you think of a God in Buddhism? And straight away I knew just a joke was not on, not with intellectuals. And number two, you can't have a simplistic answer, you have to go deep. And so I told him, he said, well look, let's start with, you know, one of my co-presenters at the time, he was the abbot of the Benedictine monastery in New Norcia. I got to know him for a long time, had some interesting discussions with him, and some jokes as well. I can't resist this. Once when I was with him, you know, that old monastery up in New Norcia, is one of the oldest buildings, you know, in Australia. So when he was showing me around, I couldn't resist. You know, it's just, I'm sorry, but this is my character. I said, have you ever seen any ghosts in this old building? And he looked at me and he said, Ajahn Brahm, as a Catholic, we don't believe in ghosts. I had him. What about the Holy Ghost then? Poking him. I was teasing him. I couldn't resist it. I should show more respect. But anyhow. So anyway, when this Father Frank Brennan asked that question, what about like a God in Buddhism? How do you perceive or imagine or deal with that question? And I realized I needed to take this deeper, not just give a simplistic answer or quote some texts. What I said to him, he said, well look, this Father Placid, many times he said this to me. He said one of his basic beliefs, sometimes I ask him about God, and honestly he said sometimes I don't know. Even his belief in a God was not that strong. So what he did say, he said, I believe that everybody is searching for God. He's a Catholic, okay. But then I respect him. So I use that as a starting point for this little discussion. If everyone is searching for God, okay, what are each one of you searching for? Why did you come here tonight? Why do you actually join a spiritual path like Buddhism? Why do you meditate? What are you searching for in your life? You could stay home and just watch the TV. I don't know what's on. I haven't got a TV. You could just go out for dinner or something. Why are you here today? What are you searching for? And then I just said, well, look, as a Buddhist, what I search for is like peace, meaning. One of the other things which I search for, made a lot of effort for here in Australia, is equity. So everyone is treated equally and fairly, you know, especially like the ladies, building monasteries for women, doing ordinations for women, supporting LGBTQIA+. I remember that time once I gave a talk over in East Perth, and this guy came up to me afterwards. He was one of the leaders of the gay community here in Perth many years ago. And he looked me in the eye and he said something which I will never, ever forget. He said, religion has been very cruel to the gay community. And the way he said that was just with such passion and sadness. I could never forget that. So I did whatever I could to try and be inclusive. And as a Buddhist leader, anyone can come in here. And so that was one of the important statements which actually drove me, you know, to do whatever I could. So don't you seek for equity? Like a fairness? Doesn't matter what race you are, where you come from, or even gender specification, or even just disabilities. I don't like the word disabilities also. It doesn't matter if you're autistic, what end of the spectrum you're in, or where you are in. No one is normal. And I can prove that. Have a look at me. It's weird. Weird eccentric monk. But the simile I use for that, I haven't used a simile for a while. I usually used to use it every week. You know, the trees in the forest. There's no tree in the forest where I've lived in my life which is perfect. They're all bent and twisted and damaged. Go and have a look at those trees. Every tree, even if you go to King's Park over here, or Hyde Park, every tree is damaged, if you look close enough. They're all twisted and bent. There's no perfect tree. I never see a perfect human being in this temple over here. I'm still waiting. Maybe one day one might come in. You may be looking for a perfect partner who's just so beautiful and so kind and just so compliant. I don't know what you want as a perfect partner. They just don't exist. But they're good enough. That's all you can get, good enough. I like that term, good enough. Your meditation, is it ever perfect? It's good enough. That's an amazing thing, to actually appreciate just what you have where you are. So anyway, so instead of actually looking for that type of perfection, we have this idea that what we need is acceptance, equity, a sense of belonging, of not being pushed out and marginalized. You know, loved. And being able to, you know, love oneself, love others. Isn't that what you would love? I shouldn't say that, should I? What you are searching for in your life. Meaning. Some peace. Another confession now is, you know, for many years ago when I was a young monk, I was visiting UK for the first time and I was being an attendant monk on one of these retreats. I'll never forget this experience. I was getting bored out of my skull, honestly. You know, same old talks, just like you. You've heard me say the same old metaphors and jokes over and over and over and over and over again. And that's what I was hearing from this other monk, getting really bored, half asleep. And then this lady came into this interview in this meditation course. And when she came in, you know, she was confident And she said, I just come in here to thank you for saving my life. The way she said it, I woke up. I was perfectly alert. What the heck has this monk done for someone actually to say that? And she told a story, this monk's kind advice. He never meant this, but it just worked for her. And after that experience, I always made a resolution. If ever I become a Buddhist monk teacher and teach retreats or come up here and teach on a Friday evening or wherever I teach in the world, if one person would come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, thank you so much for saving my life, that would give my life meaning. I wouldn't want any more than that. Just be able to, really people honestly saying that. And of course, many times, one of my favorite experiences, someone coming up to me and saying I saved their life, was in Paddington Station in London when I was a monk going to give some talks over there. And I was just minding my own business. I'd just come on the underground train to Paddington Station. I had all the tickets beforehand pre-purchased. And then going to one of the mainline trains, going up to Oxford, I think it was. And as I was walking, minding my own business, this woman, maybe about 23, 24 years of age, an Afro-English, came running up towards me. You know what she said to me? She said, hey, you're the YouTube monk. I've never been called that before. YouTube monk. And she looked at me, yes, you are, Ajahn Brahm. What on earth are you doing in London, in Paddington Station? You're supposed to be in Australia. She was really excited. So I listened to her, and then she said, oh, you saved my life. I never knew her before. In her particular case, she explained what had happened. She was a young woman. She had a partner. I don't think they were married, but the relationship never worked out. And the parting was just really, really painful and hurtful. I think you can understand what I mean. And anyway, she said after getting really, really depressed and suicidal, she had lots of friends, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, everybody to try and help her. Nothing worked for her. And so she was at home wondering what on earth to do. And then she was just searching for YouTube and got one of our BSWA talks, well done, over there in that little office. That's what saves people's lives. The people who are working in there record it all and put it online. And said that saved my... After hearing the first talk, she binged many hours on those talks, one after the other. But it worked for her. It just got her to see life in a different way. And so she overcame her depression and suicidal tendencies, and now she was fine again. So thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Imagine that job satisfaction when somebody actually means that. Thank you for saving my life. So that actually gives my life meaning. What are people searching for in their life? It's not just to have meaning for yourself. We'd be able to do something for others. Just one was enough for me. But of course, I got more than, these are extras, the bonuses which you get. When people said these talks have so much meaning, thank you. So that's what I said, that's to me. What do you search for? What do I search for? That peace, the meaning of peace, understanding everything. Equity, respect. In terms of you belong somewhere. You can add many more things than that. I said, if that's what everyone is searching for, and that's what you search for, that's what I search for, that must mean what God is. Now that type of answer, even this very strict Catholic, Frank Brennan, said, that's a really good answer, thank you. And he meant that. It was an answer which transcended the barriers which people have between faith and religions, without negating the Buddhist ideas. That was a really good Buddhist answer. It was open. It allowed people to take it even deeper, which is really what sort of answers should be, not closing off barriers. And if that's the case, you can see just how all these arguments, who's right, who's wrong, what you're doing, what you're not doing, whose land is this, whose land is that, it's not, doesn't belong to me. It always has to be ours. That's one of the wonderful things about even Buddhism. No one owns anything. It always has to be shared. I'm sharing this evening with you. We're sharing this place over here with you. You never built this. You know whose design this was? Who designed this hall? Yeah, that's right, me. I'm responsible again, I'm sorry. Not the roof, that was done by somebody else, but I designed the layout over here. So anyhow, it's my gift to you. So when you can give, you get so much meaning. It's not when you take, not when you own, but what you share. That doesn't say very much, I better stop now, because about Palestine or who owns what land, whether this is Buddhist land or whether it's somebody else's land, it always has to be our land, our place. Whoever wishes to come in here, please come in here. Share our life, share our land. Okay, that's enough for this evening. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. Okay, I got one clap. Thank you, Eddie. Thank you. Okay. Now we have some questions usually. How's the internet working? Okay. Some questions from the floor first and then from the internet. No? Of course you can, Eddie.
Ajahn Brahm, today's talk is really, really, really marvelous. I don't know how to start because you portrayed righteousness in a very broad spectrum, you know.
Okay.
Spectrum. Yeah. You talk about the maybe I should say something about the Gaza, Palestine.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the problem, okay, is self-inflicted, you know. You fail to see. The Buddha was saying, it's hard to see your own problem. It's easy to see others' problem, hard to see your problem. No. If you can put your shoes in the other person's position, you know, a lot of the problem will be solved.
Yeah. If you walk a mile in your wife's shoes, you'll have very sore feet. Sorry. That's all jokes. But anyway, can I do a couple of questions from here first of all, then more from the floor? The first question is from Netanyahu. I wish. No, first question from Germany. Ajahn, I'm very disappointed. I put a lot of effort into my relationship and it didn't work out. I don't want revenge. I'm just very sad. How can I find peace and stop crying? Don't put effort into relationships. Put love into the relationships. And not trying, but it just, we grow our emotions. Sometimes, it doesn't work out, but that's our life. Sometimes you plant a tree and it doesn't grow. You find out why. Sometimes it's in the wrong place, or not enough water, or it's the wrong tree in the wrong climate. So you learn. So the goal is not just having this perfect relationship. The goal is learning and growing as a human being, finding out more about oneself and what it takes to have a relationship with somebody else. So don't take any disappointments, so-called failures in life. They're learnings in life, not failures. Somebody quoted this to me, it's great. The truckload of dung. So the person here, disappointed, put a lot of effort into your relationship and you just got a truckload of dung. What do you do with a truckload of shit? It's the best fertilizer in the world. Dig it in. Become a kinder, more compassionate, more wise human being. You don't get that wisdom from universities or going through courses. You get it from your own experiences and dealing with it properly. Anyway, question. Hi, Ajahn. How do we help parents, family, who are always engrossed in worldly news, politics, and not interested in Buddhism? I'm worried for my parents who feeds on indulging news, politics to survive. You know, sometimes what you can do, I don't know where they live, you can buy them a ticket for our next retreat. And just send them. Or you could actually do what other people do, they buy them a nice book. But sometimes if you just buy them a book, they think you're just evangelizing. So this, I don't know where she's gone these days, many years ago, when a Malaysian girl here, married to an Australian, she told me that her husband would love to meditate and come to this place, but he just he hates religion. So I said, easy. He bought one of those books of mine, The Opening the Door of Your Heart, no, she did, take it home and tell your Aussie husband, this is my book, it's a religious book, you're not even allowed to touch it, let alone read it. And of course you know Aussie men's sort of psychology. You know, you thought, she's got no right to say that. This is Australia. So when she was out shopping somewhere, he picked it up and read it from cover to cover. And then he came here many, many, many times since. That's how you get people to start. Just have a look and see what's going on. Ajahn Brahm, how to deal with harassment, bullying and cyberbullying? I'm very stubborn. I tend to take revenge on people when they hurt me. Isn't that against Buddhist practices? Yeah, it is against Buddhist practices. There's one of my sayings. It's very Australian. There's no need to seek revenge because karma will get the bastards anyway. Okay, that's using a rude word maybe, bastards. But nevertheless, because I say that, you always remember it. That's not to offend you, but to make sure it stays in your mind. And it's true. If someone has hurt you or just treated you improperly, karma will settle things. So, no need to, they harass you. How can they harass you? Honestly, you can let yourself be harassed. When you don't allow that, they can call you whatever you like. I still remember this story. Oh, please, I'm telling too many stories. But this came up the other day. I didn't have time to tell it, so I'm taking the opportunity now. Many, many years ago, when we first came to Australia, our car was this old combi van. And we used that because we could take so much wood and other stuff backwards and forwards, you know, to Serpentine to build our monastery. And one day I was going down Leech Highway. I remember, really hot day, had all the windows open, you know, because we didn't have any aircon. So all the windows open, and I was in the passenger seat. The driver was, you know, driving the car because monks aren't allowed to drive. And we came to the red stoplight. In those days, there weren't that many sort of monks around. And there was this group of kids, maybe 18 or 19-year-olds. You know what they're like. They saw there was a monk in the car. And my window was wide open. So they started shouting at me. And they had something in their hand. And they were going at me. Look at this, look at this. And when I looked, it was a copy of Playboy. How did I know? Someone told me. I didn't know. They were trying to upset me, harass me. What I did was just laugh. I thought, well, if I was young and saw a mug in a car, I might have done the same thing, just to test them out. But you didn't really take it so seriously. You got upset and allowed the harassment to bully you. Cyberbullying is something different. But you know my favorite button? Where is it? I better not. Where's the delete button? That's my favorite button on a computer, delete. So if there's something I don't like, click, and it's gone forever. I just don't like calling it delete. I prefer to say let go, renounce, detach button. If I design a computer, that's what I would call it. Last question, how do we know if persons that we associated with are Kalyana Mitra? If they're good friends, they can inspire you. People who, number one, keep precepts. Not people who go and get drunk or just get sozzled on drugs. Just good people, kind people. So after a while, you know exactly who is like a good friend who will be with you and even in times of adversity, always be there to help you and look after you. That's only a brief answer, but you know I do have probably some more questions from the floor, and it's almost 9 o'clock now. But anyhow, so any questions from any one of you now? Yes. Resist or embrace AI. Find a middle way. I'm sure there must be some, I don't really know what AI is, honestly. Artificial intelligence. But nevertheless, to halfway. I know Ajahn Sujato, many of you may know him, over in Sydney, he was actually asking me the question that over in, of all places, Berkeley, California, some of the scholars over there, the professors in charge of the Buddhist Studies unit over there, want to translate all of the suttas, both Theravada and Mahayana, using AI. So we don't know what's going to come up, but at least we know it's not going to be authoritative. AI is not an authority. Even if it's going to translate, you know, from the Pali, or even actually find out what those original suttas are, what's been added afterwards, that takes something much more than AI can handle. And that's going to be one of the dangers. So that's something which I do know. So, again, what is truth? Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Truth is something you can actually feel. It's got a particular emotional resonance towards it. And it also, it works. It does solve problems rather than make new problems. That's why that story of, you know, what do Buddhists feel is their perception of God? You know, the answer I gave, you won't find that in a book, but it has a sense of feeling that this is something which can take human beings into more harmony and peace and to solve all these conflicts which people have. Who's got the right God? Does that make sense to you? Anyway, any other question before we call it a night? Going, going, gone! Okay, thank you all for listening. We can now pay our respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and then we can go and do what we need to do. If any of you wish, there's still going to be a meditation class tomorrow afternoon, but then in the Sunday, just the big celebrations and stuff. Really good food.